This is a podcast from ABC Overnights. Here's Trevor Chappell.
Narelle Harris is a writer and editor of The Only One in the World, a Sherlock Holmes anthology. Hello, Narelle.
Hello.
Hey, firstly, can you explain to us what the anthology's about?
It came about from a concept, I guess, that I was curious what Sherlock Holmes might have been like if he had been born in a different country and maybe in a different time. So what cultural influences might alter how he operates, maybe who he is, whilst still being kind of the essential Sherlock Holmes we know from the Conan Doyle stories. So my publisher and I, we made a list of writers that we liked who came from lots of different backgrounds or had different kind of expertise and historical periods, and approached them basically with that idea. We didn't put too much around that. We said, look, they can be any gender, any sexuality, anything that, because we don't know what might have served how best to tell a story about those different times. So we just left it open and said, go for it. And, yeah, so we came back with all these. Like, we have an Indian Holmes. We have Holmes from ancient Egypt, one from Viking Iceland, South African Jewish John Watson, and a Japanese Sherlock Holmes in the 70s during the middle of apartheid when the Japanese were given an honorary white status so that they could trade with South Africa. So the writer there, Jason Franks, goes into kind of the political and moral repercussions of that for the characters and things like that. So, yeah, that was the basic idea. I was curious.
It's a great idea. The thing is, though, you can muck around with a whole stack of things, but with Sherlock Holmes, what can't you muck around with?
I think you need to have his intellectual curiosity, rather excitable intellectual curiosity. He's out and engaging with the world no matter what is going on. He's curious and he wants to know what's going on and why it's going on. And so he's leaping in there feet first. I think that's number one. He's, he has a restless mind and a lot of energy.
Are there certain characteristics that he carries with him that are important to Holmes as well?
I think I keep saying that the idea of the original stories, particularly, and Holmes as, you know, a character, and Watson's as well as part of that, is that they're like a diamond. When you read the original stories, and there's the four books and the 60-something stories, I think. It's a bit early in the morning for me to remember numbers very well. but it's like a diamond. There's all these different facets. So there's different ways you can express the Holmes and or the Watson and retain some feeling from that original story. So, as I said, for Holmes, there's that intellectual curiosity that he wants to be out there. He's restless until he's resolved the issue. And his friendship with Watson, and, you know, that might be, you know, a brief connection, and, you know, the nature of some of these stories means that the connection has to be brief. They're from different worlds and they're not going to have an ongoing partnership, but you've got that moment of connection and friendship, and you've got Watson's loyalty, and, you know, he's not a stupid man. It's just that everyone looks quite thick next to Holmes. But he's intrigued by Sherlock, and he wants to become involved in this kind of adventure that's happening. And, you know, I guess they both like to right wrongs.
He doesn't like the way that the story is told, because the story is generally told through Watson.
And he's complained bitterly about that.
He doesn't like it, does he?
No, it's quite funny because there are two stories that are actually, almost all the stories are narrated by Watson. Two are narrated by Holmes, and one is third person because it was actually based on a short play that Conan Doyle wrote in which Watson hardly appears. But, you know, for all through the books, he's, you know, from time to time, he's just going, oh, you're taking these exercises in logic and intellect and you're turning them into romances. That's appalling. And then he goes to write one of his own and goes, oh, well, okay, I may have shortchanged Watson because I can't just, I'm apparently meant to entertain the public.
I love the way, because I read one play that he considers Watson's writing to be sensational and populist.
Yes, yeah.
Does that mean that Holmes is aloof, or does he recognise that he is an intelligent person, but he doesn't want to be perceived as something that he's not?
Well, he says more than once that he controls his emotions. I always find it interesting that he never says that he doesn't have them, merely that he's not ruled by sentiment, that I think he goes out of his way to ensure that he does not let sentiment or high emotion influence the way he judges clues or looks at the world. But, you know, at the same time, the very first time Watson meets him at St. Bart's Hospital, Watson walks in the door with Stanford. Holmes has just made a scientific breakthrough on something. And so they walk in and there's Holmes. He's practically bouncing off all the walls with glee and he's so excited and he comes running over and he's smiling and, you know. So he's like, the first meeting we have with Holmes is far from aloof. He's like this, an excitable boy who's just made a discovery. And, you know, he goes zinging around because he's, you know, found some way to tell whether or not a stain is blood, which is interesting because at the time that scientific breakthrough hadn't happened yet. So that was an invention of Doyle's.
Why do you think that? Because when you take a look at the different ways that he's portrayed, and he's portrayed in all sorts of different ways through all sorts of mediums, when you take a look at other great investigators like Poirot is very staid in the way that he's perceived, no matter who it is that's depicting him. Why do you think that people like to muck around with Holmes?
I think it's because, you know, particularly when you go back to the source material, he does all have all those facets. And, you know, honestly, the two of them together are kind of like that archetypal superhero and his sidekick. So there's, you know, there's a lot you can do with Holmes. And, like, you can change his gender. You can even change his species sometimes. But, you know, if you've got that core of someone who's engaged with the world and is active in the world and he's far from aloof in that sense, too. He'll often be crawling around on carpets, sniffing things, licking things. He's terribly unhygienic. But that means that, you know, any way whatever the world is, you can have a character that's engaging really directly with it. And then you have this other character who observes Holmes observing. So we've got, always have Watson as a filter to interpret how the Sherlock Holmes, however they're portrayed, is interacting with whatever world they're in. So we always have a door into Holmes's world. And I think that's why they work so well, I think, as a pair. You know, I'm always myself less interested in stories that are just Sherlock by himself, because I think that the alchemy of the two of them is what works really, really well.
Ted, hello.
I'm a bit of a homophile.
Yeah.
The one I like best portrayed, I can't think of the guy's name, but he's a classic English actor. I think the lady might know who
it is. Is it TV or film?
TV.
Yep.
Would it be Jeremy Brett from the Granada TV series?
No, it was actually probably more film, I think, because there are several films I think this actor did. I just can't think of the name. It's so long ago, I sort of...
Is it Basil Rathbone?
Hey?
Basil Rathbone?
Yeah, that's him.
Yep.
Yep.
And I don't mind, actually, the more modern interpretation. I can't even think of his name at the moment either. The curly-haired guy. Very logical.
Oh, Cumberbatch from BBC Sherlock.
Yeah, that's right. I don't like all the other interpretations. The two facets that I like of Holmes are his logic and his ability to shapeshift. He could change character and become an old man, you know, an old Chinese man, for example, in a month, and that sort of thing. And I had an English teacher that we shared a love of Sherlock Holmes, and as a reward, he let me, this was a holy grail, he let me take home his biography of Sherlock Holmes, and I've never been able to find a copy of it since.
Ooh, I was actually looking up some stuff in preparation for the interview because it's, you know, 4:30 in the morning and my brain's not necessarily at its best. But there is a biography that was written in the 60s by a fellow called William S. Baring Gould. So I don't know whether or not it's in print anymore, but he did a couple of Holmesian biographies. So
is there enough information, and Ted, I'll ask you this as well, by reading that, is there enough information that you can glean from the stories to be able to make a biography of Holmes?
Good question. I hadn't actually ever contemplated that, but the biography was certainly a tome, and it was certainly comprehensive, and I think it had extraneous information that was sort of provided a context of the time, rather than just getting it from the stories themselves.
Yeah. Because does he give away very much about himself in the stories themselves, Narelle?
No, I'm trying to remember, there's a couple of books in, Watson has known him for quite a long time before he discovers even that that he has a brother. And then much later there's a reference to his French grandmother and being related to the artist Vernet. He's pretty keeps cards close to his chest on that one. And, I mean, this is, if you want to step out and just look at it, the meta text, this is because Conan Doyle just made stuff up when he needed someone to do that. So, that neither of them really has a very full biography. Watson has more of one because we know that he's come from the war in Afghanistan, and that among their first encounters, we learned that Watson had a brother who was an alcoholic who has passed away. But we don't find out anything about their parents, and it's pretty close to their chest, sort of on all of that. And the Baring Gould fellow I've just talked about and his biography, I don't know if you've ever heard, but Holmesians generally celebrate Sherlock's birthday on the 6th of January every year.
Mm-hmm.
And that date only came out because Baring Gould said, well, they mentioned once being having had a bit of a late evening and the weather was cold, and he just sort of put a few ideas together from the story and thought, oh, it must have been Holmes's birthday party. So he's just extrapolated from tiny little things in the text to decide, well, that's when his birthday is, and stuff like that. So it's, Baring Gould really did just sort of kind of synthesize facts out of almost nothing. So I always felt cheerfully that I can ignore those if I want to, or I can just make up my own.
Bruce, hello.
Morning. I'm charming that you're talking as if we ever existed as a human being.
That's a delightful thing about being able to do this, Narelle, is that we're profiling a fictional character, which you can do.
Yes. Well, it's such well structured, isn't it? You remember Sir Arthur Conan Doyle was a doctor and a Scotch, I think, and he was really the forefront, well, to my mind, because I've read most of the books, of forensic medicine applied to, detective work and so on. I mean, he was well before his time. It was like nearly 100 years ago those things were written, wasn't it?
Look, I've actually done a lot of research, because I write other fiction as well. So I've actually done research on forensics and the development of that. So, yeah, Conan Doyle was reading stuff well ahead of it being used by police departments. And, forensics existed, but there were certain limitations, obviously, because the science wasn't up with it yet. But, Holmes's use of fingerprinting, fingerprinting had been around for, I think, 1858 was the first time it was kind of used for signing contracts, in fact, in India. But it wasn't adopted as a practice in Scotland Yard until 1901. So, obviously, Conan Doyle was reading all these the magazines and the reports and what was going on in forensics. And, his Holmes was always right on the edge of new technology and new science. So he'd be using telephones and telegrams. He was, into the fingerprints. And like I said, when we first meet him, he's working out how to tell if a stain is a blood stain or not. So, Conan Doyle was right on the ball with that one and made Sherlock a kind of this exemplary, figure of how to do forensic investigation.
Was he based on anyone or any number of people?
There are two key people that he's based on. I think a lot of people know about Joseph Bell, who was the leading surgeon at the medical school where Conan Doyle studied. So Joseph Bell was able to look at patients and actually tell all sorts of stuff about their lives and living conditions and things like that, from being able to deconstruct, I guess, from the person that he saw, very much that Holmesian skill. But there was another real person from much earlier, but it was spoken about, a very early policeman who started off as a crook named Eugene Vidocq. And he was this French guy, very prolific criminal, but also basically who liked to solve crimes for fun, so they effectively just let him out on the proviso that he solved crimes for them, for the French police. And he would go off and following people in disguise and stuff like that. So some of those aspects of Holmes's energy and his ability to like don a disguise and melt into crowds and stuff, you know, seems to refer to Vidocq, who was actually, you know, written about a lot in the 19th century press.
How was it and why did Watson and Holmes share a place?
Basically, Watson's just come back from the war and he's on a war pension and hasn't got any money.
Oh, okay.
and reading between the lines, possibly a little bit of a gambling habit. And so, yeah, when he talks to his mate Stamford, bumps into him after he's returned from the war, Stamford says, oh, look, I know a guy who wants to share rooms as well. So, and that's when, you know, that famous meeting, with Sherlock at St. Bart's Hospital. And, you know, effectively they're two single gentlemen who need a place to stay and can't afford a place on their own. Off they go.
Does that whole odd couple thing work there as well? Because we see that in all sorts of, as a shtick in all sorts of books and TV shows. Does that odd couple thing work particularly well?
I think it does, but there's all these little other touch points as well. One of the things I really enjoy, because I reread the entire canon every couple of years, and it's always lovely to refresh your memory about what their relationship's like. So they are very different people, certainly, but they have a lot in common, and they enjoy each other's company. And there's so many times throughout the stories where, for me, one of the there's a lovely moment when they laugh together. I mean, they're always, you know, you're frequently going through periods where something happens and they're just finding it funny, the two of them. So, you know, they complement each other very well. So they're very different, but they fit really well together.
One of the things that I find fascinating about Holmes is more his flawed aspects, in that you expect his aloofness to then make him very neat and tidy, but he's not. That he's got drug issues. He's got drug problems as well. So he's very flawed in his own way as well.
Yes, yeah, he can be a bit easily bored, and that's why he takes drugs. And at that time, of course, the cocaine wasn't illegal. It was not healthy, and Watson doesn't like the fact that he's got this drug use. And I wouldn't even call it an addiction per se. He seems to be one of those people who can take it or leave it alone. So he uses it to kind of stop his mind from, you know, whirring around and not connecting with anything when there's nothing to do. I think the boredom he finds more crushing than anything else. So he goes off on a little trip, as it were. But Watson's always concerned about, like, you know, this could really harm your health. It could destroy your mind. And for him, it's just like, why would you risk this incredible gift that you have? But yeah, just from time to time, he'll go off and just have a little binge.
Is that drug use contemporized too much when you take a look at it? Because that's a way of making him a little bit more radical or a little bit more edgy when it wasn't necessarily the way it was supposed to be in the books?
I think it can be, and partly too, because the whole relationship with drugs and drug culture now is quite different to the way it looks, you know, and, you know, the culture stuff surrounding that in the original stories. I've actually, the fandom generally is very entertaining and really well read and very smart. And there was somebody online the other day saying, really, modern Sherlock, if you really want to find some kind of equivalent of a socially acceptable way to distract yourself, is he probably should be hooked on energy drinks.
We're joined this morning by Narelle Harris, who's a writer and editor of the only one in the world, a Sherlock Holmes anthology. What is a consulting detective? Because that's what he calls himself, Narelle.
Yes, and he makes it quite specific that it's quite different to either a police detective or an amateur private detective out in the world. And he says, I'm the person that those two lots of detectives come to when they're stuck. So he's the detective that other detectives go to and they don't know what happens next.
Does he
and
get of course paid we, well?
Well, it's pretty. He's kind of socialist, is Sherlock. He takes according to their ability.
Okay.
So there are often for people who like he'll often take cases because the case interests him. But obviously he still has rent to pay. So there'll be the occasional, I think the one time he got quite snooty with someone who's going, I'll pay you anything you like. And he's just going, my fees are set and they never vary, which is a complete lie. and there's the one time when he finds, he relocates a lord's missing son and gets a check for £12,000. So, which one assumes he shares to a degree with Watson because they did the case together. He varies.
Does Watson ever talk about how he gets paid or the amount that he gets paid or whether he gets paid at all?
A gentleman would never discuss such things.
Julie, hello.
Hello.
Yes, Julie.
Hi. This is really interesting to me. I really love all of these classic detective things like Poirot, who I binged on earlier and just adored. But right now I'm watching the Jeremy Brett one on BBC, and I've seen other depictions of Sherlock. I quite like the relationship in this one with him and Watson, where it's not as bitchy as the one with Cumberbatch, where Watson's always annoyed about everything and is huffing and rolling his eyes. This Watson really adores Holmes and has a lot of respect for him, and he seems to have a much more even hand in his participation in solving the crimes, you know? I'm finding it interesting. I thought, this is an old one. I might not like it, but I really do.
Neuro?
It's a wonderful series. The Granada TV series with Jeremy Brett is the series that took me to the books. Up until then, there'd been the Basil Rathbone films. There'd been all sorts of things, but I'd always felt that Holmes was just a bit snooty and the Watson was so dim. It's sort of like, I don't know that I think well of a man who keeps, I don't know why they're friends.
Yeah.
And it seemed a bit distasteful, I think, of Holmes like that Blackadder. I don't know if you remember in Blackadder. Blackadder says at one point, I like to keep stupid people around me to remind me how good I am. And it made me uncomfortable. But then we had the Granada TV series, which from the get-go took as its guiding light the original stories. Jeremy Brett used to go around with the stories in his pocket to refer to make sure that he was reflecting how the character behaved in those particular stories. So there was a lot of eye on detail. And like you've pinpointed, my favorite Watson ever, is David Burke. To this day, if I hear that actor, if I'm in another room and I hear his voice, I immediately feel warm and safe. And then I'll have to go like, who the hell's that? Oh, it's David Burke.
Are you the same, Julie?
I guess. I was just going to say as well, I did some reading up on Jeremy Brett himself and discovered, or so it says anyway, that he had bipolar disorder and that when he was on set, he was very, not only meticulous about the script, but about the set. He would make sure that everything that everybody wore and the way that everything was placed was the way that Sherlock would have had it. And when I don't personally have experience with bipolar, but I know a lot of people who do. And his mannerisms, it's interesting that the actor and the character, to me, exhibit some of that.
Yeah, I know what you're talking about. Narelle?
Yeah, and so, one of the saddest things, I guess, because Jeremy Brett was wonderful and a lovely gentleman. If I ever get a time machine, I will go back to London to see the stage play that he did with Edward Hardwick as Holmes and Watson as well. But yeah, like towards the end of the series, you can see that his health is very bad. And that, they were trying to make all the stories, I think, and they didn't quite get to the end of all of them. And then the quality is not as good. in the last season that they did. But I always have to respect his determination.
One of the things that I like about his portrayal and also Basil Rathbone is the stature. I love that stature. And I think Benedict Cumberbatch brings a bit of that stature as well.
Yeah, there's a lot of charisma happening there.
Yeah. Which is, I guess, different to Robert Downey Jr.'s version. And I've got lots of people via text saying they like that. Personally, I thought it made him in too much of an action hero.
Yeah, it feels like, you know, there's all these different ways, as we've been talking about, of viewing Holmes and the way to do it. And that always feels a little bit, here's your slightly steampunk Victorian adventure hero. Because, yeah. I mean, he is very active as a character. Like, he does boxing, and there's the Baritsu martial art, which is kind of a made-up martial art. You know, they write in the beginning when Watson writes his list of the things that, you know, Holmes is good at and the things that he's terrible at. So, like, he's, you know, he doesn't really get astronomy,
yeah.
But he's really good at chemistry, things like that. But he makes a list of all the that he's a single stick fighter, that, you know, he does the boxing. So he's a very active man. And for given that he spends a lot of time lazing about doing coke when he hasn't got a job, he remains quite physically powerful. There's a story it's the Speckled Band, I think, where a villain, Grimsby Roylott, comes to see him and bends the poker, threatens their lives and then storms out. And Sherlock looks at the poker and bends it back and straightens it. It's like, oh, you got a lot of upper body strength there, sir.
So is that one of the things that actors can draw upon, is that they can take the character from the books and then choose which aspect of that character they want to highlight?
I think absolutely. Like, I think the reason that both of them are so textured in the books is that Conan Doyle really didn't particularly care about continuities. He would just write things. But then we're left with this body of work where we're going, well, you know, these are all synthesized into a single person. But as human beings, we're all very textured. We're all different things at different times. And we all have maybe little surprise skills that, you know, we don't necessarily reveal all at once to people. That does mean that there's, you know, you can focus on the fact that he can get melancholy and broody and then sulk a bit because there's no crime to solve. Or you can also look at the, you know, the guy who was bouncing off all the walls because he made a scientific discovery and was so excited that his friend Stanford and this stranger had walked in that, you know, that he starts telling them, then in his ebullience deduces Watson.
Laura, good morning.
Yes, look, I've been reading and watching Sherlock Holmes for a long time. I think the first TV series I watched had Peter Cushing in it, in the 60s. And I've even watched shows that are sort of based on Sherlock Holmes, like House, because House and Wilson are obviously Sherlock Holmes.
House and Holmes, quite close.
And the TV series I liked, other apart from the Brett, who was clearly absolutely Sherlock Holmes in period, was I liked the New York version, Elementary.
Because
Joan Watson is an absolute equal to Holmes in that, and she's, you know. But one thing that got me about Sherlock Holmes is how Conan Doyle has become a character himself. I mean. There was a TV series with, I think it was Dr. Bell and Conan Doyle. We had Doyle and Houdini, which was a short-lived series.
But these are all based on, you know, elements of his life as well. He and Harry Houdini were really good friends.
Yes. But that was based around spiritualism rather than anything else. And I think... What was another one? There was also a two-part series which was based on real events where Conan Doyle is trying to sort out a real case. But the most amusing ones I had was from the Murdoch Mysteries, where Conan Doyle turns up twice. and, of course, William Murdoch, the character, is clearly based on Holmes too.
Laurie, what is it that you like about Holmes himself?
I I think that Holmes is, above all else, Holmes investigates and he puts the clues together, but he's nothing without Watson.
Because that's one of the things that you say as well, Narelle, because you just love the fact that it's their team.
Yeah. And it's like Watson's there to interpret Holmes for us. I think if, and, you know, as I said, the two stories are written by Holmes, you know, his character is not someone who wants to sit here and tell stories in a kind of a romantic adventure style. He'd rather just give you dot points about what the logic was. So, you know, Watson's there as kind of the heart, which isn't to say that Holmes doesn't have a heart. He's often very kind. He's very gentle with, particularly with traumatized women. You know, for all that he says that he distrusts the sex, he's always gentlemanly. And like I said, he's frequently very kind, and things like that. So he has a heart. But Watson's really there to interpret him for us.
Yes, I love the New York series Elementary as well with, Johnny Lee Miller and Lucy Liu as a female Dr. Watson who has left the medical profession under a cloud. And she's hired by his loveless father to be his carer when he's fresh out of rehab.
Yeah.
So they live in this great, rambling, fantastic old grungy apartment in New York. And it's room after room of sort of half-set-up experiments. And, you know, there'll be a tortoise in this room and a dummy in that room. And he plays... Johnny Lee Miller plays him as a rather tetchy, obsessive character, and Lucy Liu is a Dr. Watson who just sort of kind of, she's there and brings him back into line. She's really sharp. The whole series is just, I don't know, I just found it riveting. I watched a lot of seasons of that.
And can I just ask you, though, with the change of gender of Watson, do you think that it was a good idea? In that, was it done as a... as a sort of a trend, or was it a calculated good idea to have a change of gender?
Oh, I think she was great. Like, she's really, she's just this really sharp character. There's nothing romantic in there. They sort of respect each other, but they get to know each other very slowly. I don't think it matters that she's a man or a woman. It's just, I mean, the whole look of the series is very stylish, so she brings a whole other element into it that way as well.
Yeah, how do people feel that the big followers of Holmes, Narelle, feel about there being a female Watson?
You know, it's varied. Yeah. I know that there are some really diehard traditionalists who don't even like Holmes being separated from his 19th century milieu. But, you know, that's okay. We've got any creator, if you're a filmmaker, if you're a writer, you want to have a look at how perhaps you might reinterpret those characters for a modern audience, as in, and not just the modern sensibilities, because I love the Victorian era stuff and there's some wonderful things done, but like, what are the kind of modern problems? Because, you know, the way that Holmes would deduce people doesn't work quite in the same way now. So what kind of... particularly like forensics has gone on so much, you know, come along a treat since the 19th century. So like, what kind of puzzles is Holmes going to look at? We've got much better, detective forces than, you know, the way Holmes disparaged Scotland Yard in that era. So, you know, you've got to look at what other aspects of, crime or just strangeness, because, you know, some of the stuff that, that Holmes investigated wasn't always, strictly speaking, crime, just morally dubious. So, you know, so I think there's a lot of fun in reinterpreting how the characters work, which means that you can also then change their genders, change their sexual orientation or whatever, because they just all give you different ways of looking at both the characters and our world. They, you know, they explore our world with us too. So, you know, those changes help to highlight different aspects.
Brett, good morning.
Hello there. How are you?
Good, thanks, Brett.
That's good. Look, my two favourite interpretations of Holmes are definitely, Basil Rathbone and Jeremy Brett. I grew up with both of those ones. I have seen the Peter Cushing ones, and I must say I didn't really warm to the modern interpretations, me being a bit more of a traditionalist. What I liked about Basil Rathbone, he definitely was darker, in my opinion. than Jeremy Brett. I found Jeremy Brett to be more Victorian than the Basil Rath representation. But I thoroughly enjoyed both of those characters on TV. And as far as the modern one was concerned, I've warmed to it now. I didn't like the modern interpretations in the beginning because I thought anything set out of the Victorian era just wasn't Conan Doyle. But I don't think now that we need to be locked into the Victorian era as much as what previous generations growing up with Rathbone and Jeremy Brett thought, and the original interpretations from the book.
Brett, thank you, because I've got to go because the news is coming up in literally 30 seconds. Is that one of the wonderful things about it, Narelle, is that the interpretations can be endless because of the way that they were written?
Absolutely.
Beautifully done.
Nice short answer for you.
Absolutely. Narelle, thank you for joining us and sharing us your wisdom. The anthology is called The Only One in the World, a Sherlock Holmes anthology that's been edited and put together by Narelle. And you've got a story in there too.
Oh, I don't. I wrote the introduction.
That's right.
Mostly I just pulled together all these incredibly talented, wonderful writers who, given that brief that I mentioned right at the beginning, just each of them came back with a different facet of that diamond, some different aspect.
Thank you. We're coming up to the next OBC News. You're listening to Overnights.